And hello again, everybody. I'm Rick Sanchez. We're going to be giving you today what you asked for. We know how much you appreciate when we map stories out for you. And these are the two stories that we're going to be mapping out for you. Number one, what is actually going on right now in Iran, right? And we're going to break that down for you with this map. And by the way, speaking of what's going on right now with this map, I want to show you an image, which I think is really particularly meaningful because this image is being talked about all over the world. Look at this. This is an IDF soldier. This is an Israeli soldier desecrating a statue of Jesus. Look, he's actually hitting him over the head with a hammer. Now, some people would say, well, this is out of character. Maybe it's just, a one-off, as they say in business. No, it's not. No, it's not. The IDF has become infamous lately for doing this type of thing, and they actually put these videos on their social media site. They'll go into a Palestinian home. They'll desecrate the home. They'll show dead bodies. They'll wear women's bras. They take pictures of themselves. Oftentimes, this is how they actually talk to other people and even try to get dates. So this is, don't let them tell you this is out of character. It's not out of character. And yes, the Israeli government has condemned it, but there's still a lot of questions to be asked. And people all over the world of all religions are infuriated by watching that image. Of course, the other big story that we're going to show you, and let me change the maps here now, is what's going on in Ukraine. There's the picture, and there seems to be more movement now from the Russian side, but not without the Ukrainians doing something as well. Right here, you see that little city right there? It's called Tuapse. That's where just within the last 24 hours, the Ukrainians have hit a Russian refinery. In fact, we've got some pictures of that. Let me show you the images of what this looks like, because we're going to be breaking this down as well. Apparently, one person hurt, several people injured, and this fire just raged forever, which, as you might expect, kind of explains how this war is going. Russia's fighting the war on the theater of Ukraine, where the Ukraine war is basically taking place. Ukraine is trying to hit Russian infrastructure, oftentimes energy infrastructure and even civilian infrastructure as well. So that's the situation. That's where things stand. And that's what we're going to be breaking down right now, right here on The Sanchez Effect. And we're joined once again by our favorite guest whenever we do map segments, U.S. Army officer Stanislav Krapivnik. Good enough to join us. Thank you, sir, for being with us.
Always a pleasure.
We certainly appreciate it. All right. I think we should start probably with what everybody's looking at right now, because it almost seems to change day by day. And that's what's going on right now in the war that was started by Israel and the United States against Iran. Mm-hmm. Where, I don't know what you think of this, but as far as I can tell, journalistically speaking, this is a war where it looks like Iran has the upper hand.
Absolutely has the upper hand. The U.S. is at a point where they don't know what to do. They've thrown everything they've had. They're gathering up whatever resources they've had. This 2 weeks of ceasefire. U.S. is repositioning whatever elements it can. It's bringing in another aircraft carrier, which is questionable what it's going to do, because to be able to come in close enough to do missions, they get in close enough to get hit by hypersonic missiles.
Which brings us to the point of emphasis here. Mm-hmm. Let's go over to this area where I think the point of emphasis is. You see between us right here what is essentially the Persian Gulf. By the way, that's Persia, and that's the Persian Gulf. That's noteworthy. And there's the Strait of Hormuz. Now, Mr. Trump has been saying he wants the Strait of Hormuz open, but just recently, Mr. Trump did something very interesting. He sent in Marines to essentially seize and fire on cargo ships. Where was it, Stas? Right here,
north of Oman, actually right inside the territorial waters of Iran. Because they were hugging the Iranian coast as they were moving eastward.
So that makes the Iranians then say, well, I thought you wanted to open the Strait of Hormuz. Yeah. By doing that, it's going to remain closed, which is why we're seeing oil prices spike once again and LNG prices spike once again and fertilizer prices spike once again.
Right. Well, fertilizer, you can forget about it because it's going to take, and that LNG is not going to be coming out of there for at least 2.5 to 3 years.
Really?
Everything's destroyed. So this has got to have to be rebuilt, repaired. So Qatar is off the map for a while.
Right.
Oil still can come out of there because there's still a lot of refinery work. But here's the thing. You know, I've talked to, for example, Professor Morandi, who was on the negotiation team in Istanbul. Mm-hmm. In Islamabad. And for what he's saying, you know, the two key points here, one, the U.S. wants the uranium. Mm-hmm. End of story. The Russians have come in. They've said, look, you know, we can hold the uranium as a third party. If Iran needs some of that uranium for civilian industries, we can give it to them. We'll hold it. You can expect it.
Right.
The American side, Van, said, no, you know, that's it. We want the uranium. Give us the uranium.
So that's not a real negotiation,
then. No, it's a shakedown. And the second point was, give us the Straits of Hormuz. Sovereign territory, the Straits of Hormuz are not neutral waters. Part of the Straits of Hormuz at the mouth are owned by Oman, and the rest is owned by, the vast majority is owned by Iran.
Yeah, well, it's their territorial waters.
Exactly.
Yeah, right.
What the U.S. is saying, step away and give us the islands and give us the Straits, which, you know, Trump is then going to turn around. There's two points here. Trump's strategy is try to control all the choke points, Panama Canal, the Red Sea from both ends, which he doesn't have yet.
To keep oil out of the hands of China.
To keep mass control and make money.
Yeah. And but really, the China point, I think, is an important one, isn't it?
It is.
I mean,
absolutely.
Because if they
absolutely.
Can do, it's two things. If they can mm-hmm. control the points, they keep China from being able, because China was extracting oil from Venezuela.
Right.
That's over.
Right.
China extracts oil from Iran. Trump is trying to say, you're not going to be able mm-hmm. to do that anymore, and China's not going to let them happen. Neither is Russia, by the way. Can I show you something?
Right. Of course.
I want to show you mm-hmm. something here, because this is, I think, interesting. Because the Russians have kind of not been very vocal about what's going on in Iran, mm-hmm. other than to say the obvious, which is they shouldn't have done this. But listen to the latest statement that was just put out. Mm-hmm. Here's what Mr. Lavrov, foreign minister of Russia, had to say about this whole situation.
The Persian Gulf crisis results from the unprovoked aggression of the United States and Israel against the Islamic Republic of Iran. At the same time, the war in Lebanon is escalating. Military action against the Syrian Arab Republic is expanding, with an eye toward yet another attempt to split that state, and of course, complete stagnation, which exacerbates the tragedy of the Palestinian people, both in Gaza and in the West Bank. If you look at the geographical map, the possibility of creating a Palestinian state is dwindling, and official statements are coming from Israel that such a state will never exist. There will be a state of Israel and with expanded borders. Our region will not be spared. There is no doubt that those who are trying in every way to maintain this chaos have as one of their most important goals the deepening of the rift in the Islamic world.
So here's Lavrov essentially saying this is all part and parcel with an action by both the United States mm-hmm. and Israel, not only to hit Iran, but also to hit Lebanon and other places that are being affected.
Right. And you know, with Lebanon, the southern portion of Lebanon, the Israelis are not claiming as their own yeah. occupation, take out all the people. As we saw, even iPhone maps,
yeah.
they've erased all the villages of Lebanon on their maps. As if it was a blank slate.
So it's like a takeover attempt.
Right, it is. And the Israelis are now drawing a line to the sea where the Lebanese gas fields are. And so now it's screaming, oh, those are now our gas fields on top mm. of that. So it is a takeover.
Here's what's different. And let's go over here and talk mm-hmm. about this for a minute, because this is what's affecting a lot of people all over the world. It's one thing for the Israelis, who've done a wonderful, if not masterful job, of convincing the West that all Islamists are bad people, and most of them are radical,
right?
They use that word in front of it like it belongs there, right?
Right.
But in Lebanon, and in particular in this part, there's a lot of Christians.
Oh, yeah, one-third of the population.
Which is why this image, once again, I don't know if you've seen this. Mm. How could you have missed it? The whole world is talking about this. Here's a guy with a sledgehammer knocking down a statue of Jesus and hitting him over the head. Now, the Israelis are saying, well, that guy's crazy. We're gonna prosecute him, et cetera, et cetera. The problem is this action is in keeping with what IDF soldiers have been doing for the last year.
Absolutely. There's videos that came out with churches being turned into public toilets, with St. George, a statue of St. George being taken down by a tractor, combat tractor.
Right.
I mean, just tons of these images are coming out. And yes, one-third of the population of Lebanon is either Orthodox or Catholic Christians. The Israelis previously, you know, the way the Israelis previously worked is they'd leave the Sunnis alone, mm-hmm. they'd try to ally with the Christians and go after Hezbollah. But now they're going after everyone because they're planning on just taking a chunk of Lebanon, if not all of Lebanon. for themselves. And the Lebanese don't need to be there. So they've killed a lot of civilians. They target civilians. They target, not under the pretense of targeting Hezbollah, they'll take out civilian blocks. They're leveling cities and turning everything into Gaza.
But the gig is up for them in many ways, it seems to me, because I'm hearing people who would normally not criticize them. 60% of Americans are now against Israel. Yeah. And a lot of them, it's because a lot of them are Christians who are angry at the actions, thanks to some of the reporting that's been done here, the things that are being done by the IDF in particular.
Yeah. You know, 2 years of videos of children being shot in the head, of women being murdered, and so on and so on. It's just, and they're the ones taking the videos.
Yeah.
And they're the ones posting the videos.
Let me have you put on your other hat now, and this is your military hat. Let's go back here to the Strait of Hormuz, and I want to show you the video of what the U.S. Marines just did on this cargo ship. And I want to ask you, as a military person, if this is actually a military operation, because some people are saying it's not. They're saying when a military attacks a commercial ship, that's piracy. Let's watch the video, and please feel free to talk over it. Here it is.
So they used 120-millimeter cannon to... They warned them to get out of the engine room. They shot the engine room, which makes it dead in the water, so it has to be towed, or the currents will just move it. They land here. Now, if you're in a war situation, you can attack the cargo shipping of your enemy nation, which, by the way, the U.S. never declared war, so it's not in a war situation. Second of all, this is a ceasefire, and the U.S. is still grabbing a ship during a ceasefire. So any ceasefire you have, you've just destroyed.
And they blew a hole in the cabin.
Yeah, they took out the engine room.
But there's no military personnel on there.
No.
Why would you fire at the... Aren't these civilians?
Oh, of course. Absolutely.
If it's a cargo or a commercial ship or a tanker, there's nobody there with guns.
Oh, yeah. This is an assault on a commercial tanker. I'm not sure what it was carrying. It looked like it was carrying containers. So it could be anything as far as goods. And it was inside the territorial waters of Iran, and they were heading toward the Pakistani border, territorial waters.
So does that give, then, Iran in this area a right to start firing back at either U.S. vessels or even military vessels?
You know, the only reason the American ships, the American combat ships, were that far north is because there's a ceasefire.
Right.
They're normally hanging down here because they're out of the range of most of the short-range, medium-range ballistic missiles, cruise missiles, and so on. So they ran out of the missile range because when all this started, the Abraham Lincoln was up there, and it got shot at a lot. So they ran south to get out of range. The only reason they're that far north is because there's a ceasefire.
So wait a minute. What you're saying is they asked for a ceasefire so they can calm the situation and then trick the Iranians by going in there and seizing the vessels.
Yeah, that's it. That's it. Trump, you know, the Iranians opened the straits. They said, that's it, the straits are open because they're waiting for reciprocal action from the U.S. And we're open as part of this ceasefire. Trump's administration comes back with, well, no, until you give us the uranium and basically give us the Straits of Hormuz, we're not lifting the ceasefire. I mean, they're lifting the blockade. So the Iranians bring back the blockade. So there you go. The ceasefire is now pointless. Either it's a shakedown. Either give us what we want or we're going to continue grabbing what we can.
Wait, no, you're right, and this is affecting the negotiations. I want to show you the second map we have of this region because it goes in tighter into this mountainous region that you and I have been talking about in the past when we first started talking about the possibility. Now you can see the outline of those mountains over there. You see the Persian Gulf. You see those areas. That's very... So essentially they have mountains up against the coastline.
Right.
Which gives them a... I imagine, I'm not a military guy, you are, a superior position to be able to manifest dominion of that area right there, correct?
Of course. Anywhere you land on these islands, you're within range of any artillery that's built up in those mountains.
And when you say artillery, what does that mean?
That means either tube artillery, rocket artillery. Tube artillery is what you think of a cannon or a howitzer.
Like a rocket. Yeah.
Right. Rocket artillery is the multiple rocket
systems.
And
that stuff's cheap.
Oh, yeah, of course. Everything's within range. So the only way you protect those islands is you have to march your way into those mountains and push the Iranian forces out of those mountains further north. U.S. does not have the military power to do that.
So just by the mere fact that they have and control that land and also are lucky enough to have a mountain range where they've already made holes in them and put rockets or silos to fire stuff in, does that make it almost impossible for the United States or anybody else to go in there and take back control of that small area? Navigationally?
At the state that the U.S. military is at right now, it's impossible.
Impossible.
It's impossible. Look,
why?
U.S. Army and Marines is about 550,000 personnel, but that's not combat personnel. That's everybody. That's your truck drivers, your cooks, your medics, your finance guys signing papers. That's everybody, your secretaries. The actual combat soldiers, U.S. has about 120,000, maybe 150,000 at its disposal. That would be pulling all the National Guard, all the troops from every post and base everywhere. U.S. would can't do that. To be able to do that, U.S. needs to return the draft. U.S. needs about 3 million men under arms. That's going to take at least a year and a half to 2 years to do it. You've got to be able to build up. You've got to be able to bring them in, set up the logistics.
Yeah, no, it sounds
to feed them.
It sounds like an enormous task.
Oh, it's an enormous task.
So what you're saying is the United States cannot take back control of the Strait of Hormuz. Essentially, they've lost that war. They've lost that battle.
Well, they never had that battle. That's the thing. Iran said that if you attack us, we'll close the Strait of Hormuz. Trump and his administration, his regime, were counting on what? 2 days, there will be no Iranian government. We'll just grab what we want.
So if the United States continues to send any kind of vessels in there,
they'll
military
get shot.
Vessels,
they'll get sunk.
So they can't then. And if they do, it's only going to close the Gulf more. So it's a catch-22.
Yeah.
You can't open it, and if you try to open it by force, it'll close it more.
Yeah, yeah.
Is that the situation?
Basically, yes. And again, Iran opened it, waiting for reciprocal action from the U.S., and what did Trump say? Give us the uranium and give us the straits, and then we'll open it.
That's interesting.
It's a shakedown.
Well,
it's
interesting what you just said, because that's exactly... my colleague, as a matter of fact, just did an interview just the other day, and she had a conversation, in fact, with one of the persons who's in charge. This is the envoy, Iran's envoy to Beijing, and he had a conversation with RT, the correspondent Runjun Sharma, asked him how the negotiations were going, and listen to what he says about these negotiations with the United States. Let's take that if we can.
It seems that the conditions that the U.S. is trying to impose do not show any equality or any reciprocity, because what they have adopted is actually the closure of the Hormuz Strait, threatening Iran militarily and launching a media war against Iran. And this is actually affecting the atmosphere of the talks. So it seems that what they expect from Iran is not a dialogue, but surrender. And they haven't shown any seriousness towards finding a political solution for dialogue. What they have done instead is make a lot of logistical deployments to our region and bring more firepower and equipment to this region and blockade Iran.
So apparently what he's saying, which is underscored by some of the reporting I've seen on this, is that when they have negotiations, the Iranians take it very seriously. They come in with pamphlets and documents, you know, like the Lavrov method.
Yes.
Everything like Russians, everything is overdone. We did this on this day, we had this meeting, here's our proposal. And literally with files, the Americans come in and say, are you guys ready to surrender?
Exactly.
That's what he just said. He said, all they do is they come to us, they say, are you ready to surrender? But here's the thing. It seems to me, and you made this point earlier, why would you surrender if you're winning?
Exactly. You know, and here's what's even worse. Professor Saeed Mirandi, who's a friend of mine, I was talking to him the day after they returned. And they were under threat from the Israelis to shoot down their plane as they were returning from Islamabad from the first round. And he told me, you know, not only did Vice President Vance call Trump 12 times during those negotiations, fine, Trump's his boss, right? He called Netanyahu at least around 4 times to give him briefs and take orders from Netanyahu. The Vice President of the United States is calling the Prime Minister of a separate country to get instructions on what to do.
And I know where you got that information. Netanyahu made a statement about that.
He did.
Netanyahu came out and said, the Americans are reporting to me.
Exactly.
Vice President Vance is reporting to me on the status of the negotiations. Reporting to me means that he is, that Vance is subservient to him.
Exactly. And again, Mirandi was there, and he's saying, yeah, that's exactly what they saw, him calling on that. Yeah, never mind, he's got two Netanyahu agents there as it is, Witkoff and Kushner.
Yeah.
I mean, they're absolutely IDF, Mossad, whatever you want to call them, agents.
Yeah.
They answered to Netanyahu. And now you've got Vance, Vice President of the United States of America, calling a foreign prime minister to negotiations to get instructions.
Does it? Yeah, there's no wonder that the Iranians feel somewhat slighted, if not insulted, by the way the negotiations are going. You made an interesting point about Mr. Witkoff and Mr. Kushner. You think they're more beholden to Israel than they are to the United States?
Absolutely. And that's not just my personal opinion. There's been multiple people in military intelligence from different countries have all said the same thing. They're absolutely Netanyahu's assets. You know, the Kushner family...
So they're reporting to the Israelis after every conversation they have with the Iranians.
The Kushner family and the Netanyahu family are close, and they go back.
Yes,
I mean, Jared Kushner talked about how he had to vacate his bed when Netanyahu came because he was sleeping in his room, and he's sleeping on the couch, which is funny because he's from a family of multimillionaires, so I guess they didn't have a spare bedroom.
Maybe they weren't quite so wealthy back then.
Yeah.
But let me ask you the question about that then, because I think this is really important. Why would the Iranians even attend a negotiation with two guys who've essentially lied to them, stabbed them in the back, and may have been responsible for killing some of their own colleagues who were negotiating with them in the past?
Colleagues and the families of the colleagues.
Why wouldn't the Iranians say, look, if those two guys show up, we're out. We're not talking to those sons of bitches.
Because the people who are supposed to be the radical fanatics are showing themselves to be the actually civilized people.
Uh-huh.
And the, quote, civilized people are showing themselves to be the radical fanatics.
They're still willing to talk, even though those guys, I mean, you know, I guess, you know, I worship this guy who we call the Prince of Peace, who said you got to turn the other cheek.
Yeah.
Maybe that's what they're doing.
They are. And let's not forget, there's a million Christians in Iran.
And Jews.
And Jews. And in fact, the synagogue that was taken out by the Israelis, one of the parishioners there was an Iranian general who was Jewish.
Isn't that interesting?
So, yeah, but those are the fanatics.
So, bottom line, with this particular theater right now, you believe that barring something crazy like the use of nuclear weapons, the Iranians have the upper hand
and
will likely maintain the upper hand?
I talked to several people from my own podcast that told me from their sources inside the White House that the president of the United States was ready to use nuclear weapons, and he was talked off the ledge by the military, by Vice President Vance. Short of nuclear weapons, they can't win against Iran.
Yeah. Well,
Iran can... Look, you take Karg Island, and then what?
But Trump...
And then what?
But Trump has to find a way to say, it's over, yes, but only because I decided it's over, and we won.
Exactly.
Will Iran let him do that to save face?
I don't know.
I don't either.
At this point, I don't know.
I don't either. I know.
Yeah.
This is what remains to be seen, as we say.
It is.
All right, so let's change theaters now.
Mm-hmm.
We're going to go from this theater to the other theater where we change the emphasis here on The Sanchez Effect. We're going to talk about a different theater now, and for that, we're going to show a different map. As you can see behind myself and Stas is the theater of the map of the Ukraine war. This is the wide shot, as it seems right now. And maybe one of the best ways to explain how this war is going right now is in the following terms. The Russians, as you can see, are moving into and fighting in this area here, which is Ukraine, right? Some of which, obviously, is disputed. The Ukrainians, less than what the Russians are doing in terms of the front, are trying to use their weaponry to attack into parts of, over here, parts of Russia. The latest thing that they did is they hit this city. You see that down there? It's called Tverse. That is a city in Russia with a huge refinery, which was just attacked, as a matter of fact, by the Ukrainians. Let me show you some of this video. And we're going to pick up the story from there. As we're looking at this, by the way, one person died, another person was seriously injured, the death toll could still go up, and this fire raged forever and ever. Is this the MO of the Ukrainians, essentially, to hit what are energy infrastructure, some would say civilian infrastructure, in Russia?
Absolutely. What we're seeing there on that video, first of all, those are oil storage facilities burning. The actual pipeline that's hard to destroy, it doesn't make a big fire because there's automated switch-off valves that just cut pressure. So they aim for these big storage facilities because they burn brightly and make a nice picture for the West. They do a lot of ecological damage, too. And those areas are pristine ecological areas.
Because, this is the Black Sea.
Right. These are resort areas up here. So they're now going to have acid rain. And those clouds, you know, depends on what the wind is going to blow, where
so
they're going to go.
So it's not really a military action so much as it is a look-at-me action.
Right. And, you know, they've
get attention.
Even gone as far as they've attacked the Caspian Pipeline Consortium, which is in Novorossiysk, which is owned by Kazakhstan and Chevron. That's right, 50% Chevron. And they've attacked those ships. So now they're attacking American elements.
So would you say that what they're doing is effective from a military standpoint?
No, not really. Even last year when they did the big offensive, they cut down Russian actual oil capacity by about 3%. Most of these have replaced quickly because they're just big storage facilities.
Right.
They're just big, basically big tanks. And that's it. They burn brightly. It looks good on the picture for Western media, but it's not really anything effective. The other thing that they do, though, is when they can't hit those, they look for houses.
Yeah, civilians.
They kill civilians every single day.
It's funny how Western media doesn't make a big deal out of that, do they? They kind of ignore those stories. But if anybody gets hurt who happens to be a civilian during the attacks on Ukraine, then all of a sudden, front page story, New York Times.
Yesterday, Belgrade region up here, they took a woman and her child out. They hit their house. It happens every single day.
Drones. Yeah.
They aim for civilians whenever they can.
Most of them get knocked down in big cities like Moscow, but in some of those little areas, apparently it's harder to defend.
Exactly. Yeah.
All right, let's talk about the big theater now. Mm-hmm. Let's change the map. We're going to start from north to south, and the first map that we're going to show you is the map of Sumy. This is the area not far away from where the Ukrainians tried to do an incursion into Russia, which, as we all know, failed somewhat miserably, right?
80,000 dead.
Take it away. What's going on right now in Sumy?
So Sumy, by the way, is the town that they took during that incursion where they killed...
In Russia?
Yes, into Kursk province. Mm-hmm. And they killed a lot of civilians, and they lost about 80,000 men, including a lot of mercs, Western mercs that were in there. Russia countered.
And by mercs, you mean?
Mercenaries.
Mercenaries.
Yeah. American mercenaries, British mercenaries, and so on, a lot of them.
Interesting. And the Russians, to be fair, were using North Koreans.
Well, North Koreans were on Russian territory as an ally. They weren't mercenaries. They're directly soldiers from the North Korean government.
Okay.
These are mercenaries, whether they're not directly soldiers from Britain or from wherever, but they're under a pretense that they're mercenaries.
So secretly.
Exactly. So this red area is where Russia's moved in. The aim is Sumy to make a buffer so that they cannot shoot into Russia proper. The Russian forces sent... A lot of stuff wasn't moving for a month and a half because there was an operational pause. The operational pause is caused because the ground is soaking wet, the snow is melting off, it's mud, it's black mud. You can't move in it. You can only move on paved surfaces.
So that's why we haven't seen things moving fast in the last 2-3 months.
Well, a month and a half. And it happens every year, and every year the West is screaming, the Russian army's bogged down, they can't do anything. Because technically they are bogged down, so everybody's bogged down. It's called the mud season. And the mud season's over. Now we're seeing movement up and down the entire front line.
So why do the Russians need to take Sumy? Why is Sumy important for the Russians to contain?
Two reasons. One, because they're firing from Sumy into Russia, into Sudzhe, and toward the nuclear...
When you say they, you mean the Ukrainians.
The Ukrainians.
Correct.
And their handlers. There's a nuclear power plant right up there, the Kursk nuclear power plant.
It's funny you say their handlers. You mean the British.
British.
And the Americans.
And the Americans, and the Germans, and the French.
Fair point.
Yeah. And the Poles, too.
So they want to create... The Russians need a buffer to keep these things from hurting their territory.
Right. So the Russian military is right about right there. It looks like there's a big difference, but the reality is Russia is in the second line of defense for Sumy. It's in the middle of that area, working its way through. And that happened about a week ago. They started breaking through. And from that point to the northern tip of Sumy, because it's much bigger than just that dot, is about 10 kilometers, 6 miles for those on the standard system. A nice little walk in during the day. Yeah. So it's right there. The Russian soldiers, the Russian troops are getting close to the edges of Sumy. And probably within a month, they may break through and reach Sumy by that point.
So within a month, you think the Russians will take Sumy? How significant?
Not take Sumy, invest Sumy, start to siege it.
Got it.
And then there's...
Surround it.
Right. And then there's movement just the last couple of days. This area, those red areas have been taken, and they're moving... that's about a 30-kilometer move.
So eventually the plan would be... You see that red color, that pinkish color there? Mm-hmm. To take all of this right here and make it that same color. That's the goal.
Exactly.
2-3 months away.
And Sumy 2, by the way, is a key logistics hub. You can see the road networks that are going into Sumy up and down the entire border area. So this is a key logistics hub that allows Ukrainian forces, Ukrainian multi-launch rocket systems moving up and down and shoot into Russian territory.
So final point. Now that the ground is dry, you expect this will increase in efficiency and speed, which means it could be 2-3 months away from them being able to do this if all things work well for them.
I think within maybe a month, month and a half, Sumy is going to be under siege. Sumy is a city of about 250,000. It's flat. It's wide open. It's one of those places you can't really defend it.
Month, month and a half.
Before the siege starts.
Interesting. Let's change maps. Are you ready? Let's go to Kharkov, right?
Let's go to Kharkov.
Let's go to the map that shows Kharkov, and I think that's going to take us right over here. There's the city. This red area or pinkish area is where the Russian forces are right now. Tell us what's going to happen beyond here.
Now, Kharkov, Ukrainians have been launching direct attacks from Kharkov into Belgorod. That's Belgorod right there, that city.
Right.
It's not marked, but... And they're shooting directly into the city center, hitting civilians. And they've been doing this for quite a while. So Russia's been moving down to take that area under control. So what we're having right now is Volchansk has been taken. Mm-hmm. Russian forces are coming up, closing off that area right north of the Volchansk River.
Mm-hmm.
Meanwhile, we have Kupinsk, which is one of the big urban fights that's going on.
That's happening now.
Well, this is like the fourth battle over Kupinsk, because the Ukrainians threw everything they had into Kupinsk to try to take it back. After it was taken by Russian forces, Russia is now clearing them back out. Russia holds over half of Kupinsk, and the Ukrainians are being pushed out of the rest of it. And the Ukrainians are having to move forces up there to try to stop Russian advance on the north. What's going to happen from Kupinsk, Russian forces are going to advance all the way up to the water reservoirs right here.
Yeah.
And it's going to cut off that entire portion of Kharkov.
This right here.
That whole portion. That's going to be a big enclave that's going to be cut off and then can be cleared. So if the Ukrainians are smart, they'll evacuate. If they're dumb, and they've shown themselves to be dumb on almost all of these, they stay way longer than they should. They should be stepping back.
Or forced to.
Right, are forced to.
By, as you say, their handlers.
By their handlers.
Words, Europe.
Yeah, yeah. Mm-hmm. It's the same strategy, by the way, Hitler used a lot. He would force the troops to stand there, and they get surrounded and wiped out. They don't seem to have learned, thankfully. So they're in this pocket, all the way down to the Serbranka River up here. They're going to be cut off. And then they're going to be, that pocket's going to get cleared. And then from that pocket, from the water reserve to Kharkov, going westward, it's about 15 kilometers.
So the end goal, I would say, if that's the proper word to use for the Russians, would be to not only turn this into that pinkish red, but eventually use that as a way of moving into and controlling and taking over Kharkov.
Kharkov, which is, by the way, from its foundation, a Russian city. And always has been a Russian city. These territories were all Russian territories that the Bolsheviks, when they created Ukraine, they took all this Russian land, Novorossiya, and they put it together with Malorossiya, which is the western regions, and they created Ukraine.
A little while ago, you said something about the fact that you're almost hesitant to say Ukraine is firing, Ukraine is doing, because you're saying these are operations that are being controlled. The real mandate is coming from Europe for the most
part.
Interestingly enough, I have something I want you to listen to. This is the Belgian chief of defense describing what's going to happen in this war, why it's happening that way, and why they are indeed, he's copping to this, running this operation to make sure they can punish Russia, because they say if they don't do this, Russia will attack Europe. That's what they're saying. Here it is. Take a listen.
2030 is going to be a difficult time for Europe. By then, the war in Ukraine, we hope, will be over. Russia will be there with its army of 650,000 to 700,000 seasoned troops. So, in 2030, we must be able to tell Vladimir Putin that even without the Americans, he will not win the war against Europe. We still have a few years ahead of us, thanks to the courage and blood of the Ukrainians, who are buying this time for us. That's why we support them so strongly.
So you say they're calling the shots. I think I just heard him say they're calling the shots.
Look, Russia has no interest in invading Europe. I've got friends in Ireland, and the Irish government's telling them the Russians are going to swim over to Ireland and invade Ireland. Why?
Why would Russia want Ireland or any of those European countries when they already have more hydrocarbons, more resources, more timber, and more land than any country on Earth?
And look, Europe is collapsing. The European Union's collapsed. Economically, it's collapsing. Everything's collapsed. Why does anybody need... They don't have anything anybody needs.
So it's about money, isn't it?
It's kickbacks off this war. The money goes to Zelensky. He and his take a share. The rest of it flows back to the European leadership, to the elites, and they get money. It's money laundering.
So it's basically they're feeding the defense industry.
Exactly.
A war every so many years so they can make more weapons, and then they make money from making those weapons. It's like banks. It's the
exactly.
same thing, right? It's a bank for them.
And the banks are in on this.
Yeah.
Look, the $90 billion that they keep talking about, for example, it's over 2 years, so it's $45 billion a year. $15 billion to Ukraine so they can take chunks out of it and push back. The other $30 billion each year goes to the defense industry. To their buddies in the defense industry.
So they,
they buy stock on.
It's almost like they're making up a fictitious situation just so they... And what do you think of the final comment he makes there where he says, thanks to the Ukrainians who are giving their lives for us?
Look, the Europeans have already started rounding up people. We saw Mertz was talking about, there's 300,000 Ukrainian men. We're going to send them so they can save their country. Well, according to Ukrainians...
You mean kick them out of Germany?
Right, and give them into the hands of the press gangs.
Yeah.
Look, according to Ukrainians, the French have already handed 40,000 over to them.
Yeah.
And these people are thrown with minimal training right into the meat grinder and have their lives thrown away.
It's a fascinating comment. I mean, we should put that one like on speed dial because they're essentially admitting to the very thing that they're being often accused of. All right, we're switching the map once again. We just showed Kharkov. Now we're going to go to Donetsk. I know this is one of your favorite regions to talk about. It's where most of the media has always paid attention, in particular because of all the things that have happened, as the West say, in Pokrovsk, right?
Right.
So let's talk about that. What's happening here now?
So the main fight here, first of all, is still in Kharkov Oblast up in Krasny Liman, which is the doorway to Slavinsk. Because you can see the roads coming in. Slavinsk is the logistic hub for Krasny Liman. The bottom red area right there, it actually goes further out right now. And Russia has that one main road already under control by FPV drones, so nothing gets in, nothing gets out. And about 50% of Krasny Liman is now in Russian hands. Once that's done, Slavinsk is absolutely the open door that you move into Slavinsk. Konstantinovka, it's a slow fight that Russia holds about 50, 60% of the city. It's a slow fight because Ukrainians have thrown everything they have, all their reserves into it. They're trying to stay this open. Once this falls, once Krasny Liman falls, you've got Slavinsk and you've got Kramatorsk and that area. This is the last fortresses. These are the last fortress cities.
Why is this Ukraine... so? Everybody, this is like the point of emphasis in this war. Why is that? Why is this more important than some of the other regions?
Well, first of all, the Ukrainian army has this, they have this tradition. Every army has a tradition. Their tradition is to put their heads in a noose and not remove it when they have a chance to. And they stay there until they get cut off and then they get wiped out.
Is this where most of the Ukrainian defenses are?
These are the best defenses. This is what's left of those defenses that they were developing for the last 12 years, pouring tons of concrete, reinforced concrete, putting firing ports, reinforcing the buildings as fortresses. This is it. This is the last big line of defense of that first defense line. Past this, you still have defensive positions, but they're not prepared. They're not prepared like this. They're desperately trying to be prepared. But this is the last big formation of the Ukrainian army that's dug in. Everywhere else, it's a much more fluid battle.
So if they lose these defenses, or if they get pushed back from this position where they've put all, I imagine, their infrastructure.
Right.
Right? Then they got big problems moving that way.
Even right here. Look, Russia is breaking through right here at Dobropolye. This is Dobropolye, Dniepropetrovsk. These names repeat. That's why I'm emphasizing that. Russia's pushing through. It's pushing its forces in this way. And it's cutting off Kramatorsk and Slavinsk from behind. So quite literally, these areas are going to find themselves fully isolated. They're going to have at least, there's probably at least 10, 15,000 troops, maybe more, in this area. And they've got no place to go. Stand in place and die or surrender.
And does the same thing you told us before about the other regions, for example, in Sumy, which is way up north, stand true here? And that is that this area is now becoming more dry, which means as a result, the soil dries, the Russian army moves faster.
Absolutely, absolutely.
So we can expect this to move faster?
Right.
Yeah.
And the Ukrainians are starting to run out of troops. This is why, you know, because if you listen to Zelensky, he'll tell you that we've lost like 50,000 men. Well, it's more like 2 million at this point, KIA, and probably another million and a half that are too wounded to ever come back.
What about the Russians?
Russian losses are much, much lower. This is the level of losses on the Ukrainian side is incredible.
Yeah.
Because Russia controls the air, Russia controls the artillery battle, and the people that the Ukrainians are pushing through are untrained. You know, the Russian army has rotations. They'll have a battalion up front. It fights for 3-4 months. It rotates out. The next battalion comes in out of this brigade, and they do brigade rotations. The Ukrainians, once they get to the battlefield, they only leave on a stretcher or they never leave.
Well, there was a time when the losses were all but equal, but that's changed now, right?
That was a very short time. And even, you know, when Bakhmut, which is right here.
Right.
When Bakhmut
on the move to Pokrovsk.
Right, right. When Bakhmut was an issue, I remember watching an interview with a Ukrainian truck driver, a military truck driver. He's like, you know, I drive the fresh guys in the morning. I drive the remains out in the evening.
Wow.
They don't last a day because they're not prepared. They're just throwing meat in. That hasn't changed. Whenever they can, they throw people in with no training. Here, this is the end of the rifle that the bullet comes out of.
Yeah.
You're gritty, and off they go.
You've got to give credit, though, to the guys who do get there, because it seems to me that these Ukrainian soldiers fight hard as hell.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's kind of in their their psyche, so to speak.
It's the Russian thing.
Let me take you to the final map, and this is the map of Zaporozhye. And Zaporozhye has also become a very important part of this theater, and it's also been ever-changing. What's the big story here?
So this is Dobropolye, Zaporozhye. Again, these names repeat, so not to get people confused.
It's the same name, but a different enclave.
Exactly. At the end of winter, the Ukrainians launched three offensives. They launched an offensive northeast of Dobropolye that had some success. They got through the first line of defense. They got up to the second line of defense before they bogged down. And they were throwing a lot of people and equipment into that, and they were losing a lot of people and equipment. That is now being taken out because the Russian forces are moving in, and they're starting to cut off those areas that are still under Ukrainian control that they took back. And they're being re-liberated. Now, the second offensive that the Ukrainians launched was north of Gulyaypolye. That offensive got stopped almost instantly, got destroyed, and Russian forces have rolled forward from that. And the rolling, if you can see that little, that's absolutely confirmed in the liberated by Russia. There's the red areas.
Okay, got it.
Outside of that, that's all gray zone. And the gray zone goes for another couple kilometers. That's disputed, that's being fought over. And from there, the roads go to Orekhov. Orekhov is this long, thin city.
Right.
Right, along the main corridors, interstate corridors. From the south, it's already invested by Russian forces. So there's already fighting southeastern edges of the city. These forces from Gulyaypolye are about 10 kilometers out and closing. They're going to hit it from the east. These forces are coming in from the west, and they're also about 7-8 kilometers out.
7 or 8 kilometers?
Yeah, there's one city right there. Well, it's one town right there that's in the way they're closing in on. And again, they couldn't move because, the ground was mud.
Right.
So you really couldn't move. It's pretty open area.
So they've been stalled for a while.
Right.
Because of Mother Nature.
Absolutely. It happens every single year. Yeah. And again, every single year, the Western press starts screaming, see, they can't
they
go.
They ran out of ammunition or something.
Yeah. It's just like every August when the tourists start leaving Crimea, they all start screaming, see, all the Russians are running away from Crimea. It happens, and they repeat it. People believe this every single year. They get a graphic one. They have to report what? The other area that they were attacking is in this area to try to push Russian forces back.
Right.
They failed. It's been stalemated. They were they didn't succeed in the mission that they had. The mission stayed and pulled Russian troops out. But that area is more or less stabilized for now.
And this is at Dnieper?
Yeah, yes. That's the Dnieper. Yeah. And from here, the Russian Russia grabbed that crossing right there. And that's about 10 kilometers to the edge of Zaporozhye.
So would the final end goal here be to get right to the shoreline of the Dnieper River? And essentially, you've met your result that you've been looking for? Or will they cross it?
They have to cross it because you have to take that. That's the edge of the oblast, the edge of the province, this red line right here. And in the end, they have to cross it because down here, you have Kherson that has to be retaken.
Yeah, also is a part of it. Right.
Exactly.
How long? Well, let me do this. Mm-hmm. Because the European leaders have been mm-hmm. making so many predictions, and you just heard that the defense mm-hmm. chief in Brussels essentially explain what their plan is and how long it's going to take until the year 2030, mm-hmm. et cetera, et cetera. Mr. Putin apparently heard that and reacted to it. Here's the comment that he just made within the past 24, 48 hours.
Military action is always a very complicated and dangerous thing. We know how everything will end, but we will not make any public statements about it. We will simply strive to achieve the goals we have set. I am sure they will be achieved.
He's saying we have a plan mm-hmm. and we'll be done when we're done.
Right.
And don't pay attention to the other guys talking right. silliness or whatever, how he described it. What is your take on it?
Oh, that's exactly
where are we really in this thing, and how much longer will it take?
It's never easy to say how much longer. If it wasn't for the Europeans, Ukraine would have been done a long time ago, and yeah. they were in peace already. But the Europeans have thrown in tens of thousands, or actually more like hundreds of thousands of mercenaries. Right now, there's mercenaries coming from Colombia and Mexico, from the gangs, from the club, from the cartels. They're cycling them through, getting them combat experience to go fight their own governments and the American government.
Yeah.
By the way, that's something nobody wants to talk about. Actually, Washington Post did. 70% of the heavy weapons in the hands of cartels are from Ukraine.
Yeah.
They get laundered back.
So is Mr. Trump still backing this war, even though he says?
Let's be honest. He is.
Yeah.
He's, quote, selling equipment to NATO for money NATO doesn't have.
So this continues to be yeah. a war where the West is attacking Russia
right.
and they're using Ukraine to do so.
Absolutely.
Is that fair?
Absolutely. To the yeah. last Ukrainian.
Wow.
Yeah.
Thanks, man.
Thank you.
As usual, really, really good. We wanted to finally, you know, we hadn't had a chance because of mm-hmm. what's going on in Iran to break down this theater or give it a good, hard look. Obviously, this is a break point because the seasons right. are changing. So this is where we'll start to see the picture kind of change. And nobody better than you to take us through that picture to show
Thank
us
you.
How it works. Thank you, my friend. And by the way, viewers always appreciate when we do this for you. We get the most comments when we do these map segments.
Maps are good.
So thank you. Thank the crew. Thank the photographers who are holding this camera. And it's very heavy and the poor guy's starting to sweat. So we got to let him out of this as well. And most of all, thank you for letting us into your homes. I'm Rick Sanchez, and we'll be looking for you next time.